I got involved in Russia, and he was very much a breath of fresh air in Russian politics. He, of course, he had a history already in Soviet times of being an activist after Chernobyl, and he was trying to get elected in Soviet times and was maybe not so successful, but eventually he got into politics, and in the 90s he was a very central person, of course, and served in several governments. But he was always a different type of politician, and someone who, both through his charisma but also through his intelligence, his wit, stood out in so many ways. And of course his political career changed over time, and he became, but he was always a central person in Russian political life. And he was always had courage and showed very much that he was willing to, he believed very much in what he was saying in his engagement. So for me, he was certainly, having worked in Russia in the 90s, a very important person. I think Oksana is going to say a little bit more. So this is...
I'm so sorry.
Old stage, you know.
We were prepared, so we have an extra chair here for just in case. I think this is... I'm sorry about that. So this is what happens when you arrive a little bit late.
It's a punishment.
Yeah. No. So before I hand over to Oksana, yes, let me say a few words about Oksana, because I had the pleasure of working with Oksana for several years in the EBRD, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and she was very much a leading light on understanding political and social developments in Russia, but also in Ukraine and in Turkey, and it was always a delight to have someone who had such a long history and of involvement in the region and clear thinking, and she's still very much engaged and part of the Valdai group, and as many.
We have a changing Russia, changing population. There's most of the opinion polls now are showing increasingly that Russian people, almost across all the sections of the society, want change. They want different change. But almost 70% of the population agree that Russia needs reforms. 27% think that reforms have to be bottom-up. They have to really focus on building civil society, and building the entrepreneurship, opening up economic competition, and opening up political competition. But at the same time, we also have something like 47% of the population who believe that reforms should be top-down, and that they have to continue strengthening the state, they should continue the recent trajectory of centralizing the political power in Russia. So I think this evolution is very, very, very significant. We also see the rise of the new generation. The protests that we have seen recently in Russia were protests of very young people. Many of them probably were never knew any other leader in Russia than Vladimir Putin, and they want to see change. They want to see not only change of personalities, but most importantly, they want to see institutions, they want to see real competition and free and fair elections. And of course, finally, we also see the change in the social contract in Russia. The old social contract, which was very much at the center of the political system in Russia throughout the 2000s, which was based around the notion that Russia sees the increase in living standards in exchange for, more limited political freedom, that is no longer possible because the economy has been stagnating, and it is clear that without serious economic reforms, the increase in living standards is not going to be delivered. Even though Russian economy has returned to growth this year, the real incomes continue to shrink. So all these things are happening underneath the surface. And it is a big question mark now whether the Russian political opposition, which is now again becoming more active ahead of the elections, will be able to capture those changes in society and will be able to translate that into a new phase of more competitive and inclusive politics in Russia. So we have a really fantastic panel today to really talk about that and try to help us understand what is happening in Russia. So first, Professor Richard Sakwar. I know Richard for many years. He's really one of the best experts in the UK, but also more globally on Russian politics. He published many books, including most recently one about Russia against the rest and the changes to the global order. This has been just fresh off the press in Cambridge University Press. I haven't read it yet, but we're not going to discuss this topic, but Richard has also written a lot on Russian opposition and domestic politics in Russia. Professor Tamila Lamkina, who is over there, who is one of the really leading experts on the protest movement in Russia. She's been monitoring the evolution of the protest movement for many years. After that, Vladimir Ashurkov, who is working very closely with Alexei Navalny, but also has been the head of the Anti-Corruption Foundation and been really looking at the issue of corruption in Russia, which is very much galvanizing the protests in Russia now. And last but not least, Vladimir Karamurza, who is here to present later on a film about Boris Nemtsov, but who also himself a politician who has been very active in Russian politics for many years and who is now with Open Russia supporting the evolution of civil society in Russia. So let me start with Richard. Richard, can you maybe give us your view on how the political opposition in Russia evolved and what are the prospects for it in the next elections?
Lovely, thanks so much. Great pleasure to be back here, even though I must say this has been a journey from hell. And just to the train was late 15 minutes on high speed one, the tube Piccadilly doesn't go on for 10 minutes, and then arrived here to a chair. So it's all good fun. In fact, I'd have been disappointed if it hadn't happened. So, okay, I've just got a few minutes, so I'm just going to make a few key points. Basically, my thoughts are sort of organised in the way that Oksana has asked, but looking for an opposition. And I'll just make a few specific ideas. The first one is that the system is multifaceted, but basically, I'm going to go back to my dual state idea. You actually have the constitutional system does, obviously doesn't operate unfettered, but it does constrain and limit the actions of the regime. So there's a constant tension between these two systems going on. And it's within the framework of the tension between this constitutional state and the administrative pressure and the informal methods of the regime, the Kremlin-based system, a little more complex than that, but basically. And there's a constant tension, and therefore there's space for opposition within that framework. And genuine opposition, putting forward ideas, alternatives, and so on. However, it is limited and stymied always. So that's the first point. Secondly, just to say a few words about the systemic opposition. I know that this term systemic and non-systemic is becoming a bit anachronistic. Nevertheless, we do have the four major parties in the Duma today. The United Russia, obviously, Communist Party, the Liberal Democrats, Just Russia, Svobodnaya Russia. Now, these parties clearly are, even the regime itself is tired of them. You listen to commentators, there's talk of rebooting United Russia, there's talk of re-establishing. It was quite clearly, it never has been able to shake off Navalny's, Navalny popularization of the framework back in 2011, 2012, the party of thieves and swindlers. And obviously, it's a party off power, not a party in power, which makes it always a very uncomfortable position. Is it just simply a skeleton, a bureaucratic machine for advancement, for passing laws, for doing all sorts of things, rather than a living political organism? So that's facing its dilemma. As for the other three parties, the Communist Party, the LDPR, and Just Russia, there is a lot of talk. We do know that there are even plans being hatched in certain dark corners of the Kremlin to try to merge them all, to merge the three, that is, into some sort of left-centre opposition, because obviously Just Russia, Sviatlivo Rossiya, under Sergei Milonov, after its some of its leading figures, the Gudkovs, Ilya Ponomaryov, in 2011-2012 took a leading part in the opposition. Since then, of course, they were purged from the party, they were purged from the Duma. And so, under Mironov, the Sviatlivo Rossiya, Just Russia, is very much, even many of its leading figures, I've just come back from Moscow, have left it. They want nothing to do with it, because it's a moribund organisation. It's a member of the Socialist International, but it's quite clearly unlikely to do very well in the forthcoming, well, they've just had the elections, but in the future elections and so on. So Sergei Kiryenko has the grand plan to merge these three parties. It's being resisted by Volodin and the Duma. It's an unviable plan. I don't quite see how they could do it, but that's the sort of talk. But it's symptomatic of the fact that the systemic parties themselves, so-called opposition parties, are in some sort of crisis. So that's the second point. As for the third one, the non-systemic opposition, as I say, the term itself is anachronistic. Nevertheless, it does cover those parties not in the Duma today. So obviously the key one is Yabloko, and Yabloko is quite active. It's always had a deep grassroots penetration in the region, so we know that its representatives in Petrozavodsk managed to win the mayoral election some time ago, and that Yabloko is still now part of the active opposition. And obviously since 2012, the party registration laws have been loosened, and today some 77 parties are registered by the Ministry of Justice. So in other words, from what we had in the 1990s, early 2000s, over-partification, and then the tight party laws from 2001 reduced it down to 7 in 2011, and we're now back to endless parties, many of them spoiler parties, in particular spoiling the communists. The communists themselves seem to be particularly targeted to split their vote. Non-systemic parties, many plans after the mobilisation of 2012 to establish a democratic front, to establish some sort of permanent organisation, all those plans came to nothing, and even the major moment when the Republican Party of Russia under Vladimir Ryzhkov was registered, we really thought with Ryzhkov, I think he's quite a talented political leader, that something was going to happen, but they became part of the Parnas bloc, Democratic Union, and after leadership contests and so on, the shell of that grouping has been left now under the head Mikhail Kasyanov. So non-systemic of the, if you like, traditional non-systemic is not doing exceptionally well. But the fact is, and my fourth point, that after the 2011-2012, we do see what you could call the rebirth of politics. It's still there, even though the organisational form of that mobilisation in 2012 and 2011-2012 didn't come to much. There is still a legacy going on of the White Ribbon movement for free elections, for fair elections at Chesnaya Vyborye, which was the slogan in 2011-2012. So there's quite a lot going on at that level. And this is where I say that within the interstices, within the framework of this dual system, there is space for opposition in all of this. And some of the legacy is new patterns of opposition have emerged. The legacy was both official in terms of what Medvedev did in reforming the party, the electoral and other systems. And there was, I know that I'm much criticised for it, but there was an attempt to reset the system from above. This was initially headed by Volodin, who was talking about, it wasn't liberalisation, it was simply deconcentration a little bit from below to allow some pluralism, some more dynamic in local elections and so on. Which brings me to my next point, I know I don't have long, which is to say that, that there were new patterns of opposition as a result of this regime reset. whether they liked it or not. So an enduring, not organizational legacy, but an enduring political legacy of the opposition movement. Obviously, one of the key ones is the Navalny's very huge activism. I'll come back to that. But also the in local government. I mean, there's a whole list of the people here that that you know. Opposition has been 2012 and 2014. Opposition has won mayoral elections in Yaroslavl, in Petrozavodsk, in Yekaterinburg, in Novosibirsk. So there was a genuine sense at the local level, at the mayoral level, some change. Obviously, we know there was an amendment to the law on municipal government, which passed in May 2014, which undermined mayors, and almost all of them have now gone to the city manager model, which some of them, as some of the mayors, have remained as legatees. Roisman, for example, but with even fewer powers, and obviously, and also he was not allowed to contest the regional gubernatorial election last year because of the municipal filter. But still, there's still lots of things going on, which now brings us to where we are today. And the question is, are we beginning to see the emergence of a genuine opposition, an active independent movement which is escaping or managing to exploit the tension between the system and the constitutional system and the regime? So, obviously, the biggest event of all of this is Dmitry Gudkov's creation of the United Democrats Project in Moscow for the municipal elections just a few months ago, in September 2017. Yabloko, interestingly enough, participated in this movement, the United Democrats Project, because, I mean, very unusually, for one of the few times Yabloko actually got involved in an alliance, because it's been a proud boast for nearly 20 years that it remains on its own. Sometimes it was wise, but this time I think it was wise to unite. And of course, the United Democrats won 176 seats out of 1,502. They won 176, a further 108 were won by independents, and over 70 by the systemic opposition. So if there's plenty of commentary now saying that as Putin and as the leadership looks out of the Kremlin, they're looking out at some of those local districts under opposition management. Already there's huge fights, many of them were not allowed to take over the chairmanship of these councils and so on. But it's a sign of contestation re-emerging in the Russian political system. So to say, there's lots of opportunities and lots of space in it. And of course, all of that is brilliantly exploited by Navalny in all sorts of ways. Very powerful, slick, very effective videos viewed. The one about Medvedev has been viewed 27 million times now on YouTube. That's quite something. So a huge effect, and very, very powerfully made. Yuri Chaika, the one on Chaika, also has had a lot of viewings. And so Navalny, you could say, almost to the point in which there's only two independent political subjects in Russia today, and the other one is Putin. So so Navalny and Putin really are, in a sense, they make their own political weather to a certain point. He becomes the charismatic face of the opposition. He's also, of course, has endured much criticism. His debate with Igor Girkin and Strelkov a few months ago didn't lead to an increase in his luster. He seemed to be lackluster. Strelkov, very powerful. And the key point when we're talking about opposition, the real opposition always would be ethnic Russian mobilization. I'm leaving aside North Caucasus and other types of mobilization. It's ethnic Russian mobilization. However, I mean, of the 117 political prisoners, if you want to use that term today, most of them are nationalists, ethnic Russian nationalists, just a few human rights and other independent politicians, but it's ethnic nationalists. And in other words, after the excitement of the Krim National Movement in 2014, Putin has more or less effectively put the genie of Russian nationalism back in the bottle. And it's not allowed to become independent, so which gives room for the democratic opposition. So the final point then, Putin's fourth term and beyond. We still don't know how Putin is going to run, I mean, if he hasn't announced it, as you know, but more or less certainly as an independent, and that's an important signal, that he doesn't even want to run on behalf of United Russia. So it's, it shows his independent status, almost certainly will emphasize his distance from the ruling elites. And obviously Putin's leadership always evolves, even though it's always based on balancing factions, groups, and blocks, and so on. And it's, I mean, he's not physically tired. If you look at him, he's still very active. But he is tired of that form of political management. And so I do anticipate there may well be big changes, given the fact that after 2018, this will be Putin's almost certainly last term. So the time horizon for change now is 2024, when his next six-year term comes to an end. And in that time, I do envisage a restructuring of the political space from above and also from below. So clearly, the final point would be to say that the Russian political situation today, in historical terms, remains open. By that I mean many fundamental questions have not been resolved, even the nature of the capitalism it'll have, relations with the West, and so on. But it remains open because the fundamental questions of political identity and international affairs is in part derived from the closed nature of the political system. The policy questions are suppressed rather than resolved. And this means there's another tension between the closure of not dealing with issues and the need to deal with them, as it were, opens up space and tension and friction and dynamism. There is therefore scope for political opposition and democratic to opposition to exploit openings and opportunities. But it also means, of course, that the regime works to ensure that these opportunities do not threaten its own power or the stability of the system. Therefore, a political opposition exists, but it survives in the interstices of the administrative and constitutional systems rather than becoming a formal part of the political system itself. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for this very, very rich overview. I think there's a lot in it, and I'm sure you could have debated many points. But Camilla, restructuring from below, as Richard mentioned, coming up, you know, can you tell us what this restructuring from below could look like based on the process that we have seen?
Sure. First of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for... I think I can speak without the microphone,
and you can probably...
Because we are doing
a podcast.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak at this event. It's a great pleasure for two reasons. One is I'm sitting on a panel with the Russian activists who are the kind of the beacon and light and inspiration for the future of Russian democracy. So it's a great privilege for me. And secondly, because I am part of a panel that is and that is will be followed by a screening of the film on about Boris Nemtsov. And Boris Nemtsov is somebody who made me interested in the study of Russian regional and democratic politics more than 20 years ago. That just tells you how old I am. But it was over 20 years ago that I kind of started thinking about studying regional politics, because at the time, in the early 1990s, Boris Nemtsov was a kind of young, charismatic governor of Nizhegorodskaya Oblast. And, you know, he was the kind of reformist, democratic leader that, you know, that was really the inspiration for the future of Russia. It's very symbolic that he started off as a regional politician. He ended in kind of regional politics in Yaroslavl Oblast. And that was also very symbolic that, you know, in order to understand what is going on in Russia in terms of democratic processes and civic activism, etc., we have to look at the nexus between the regional and the national. And that's what I've been looking, that's the angle I've been taking in my own work on Russian regional protests. And I'll take you through some slides. I realize I do have only 5 minutes, so I will try to stick to the time allocated. Let me begin with this very depressing slide, which kind of summarizes the trends in regional protest activism. It kind of sums up the kind of decline that we observe over the years since those very prominent mobilizations of 2011-2012. This is the data I've been gathering for all Russian regions activism from the website called namarsh.ru. It's a website supported by the opposition politician Garry Kasparov. So it's by no means exclusive data, but it kind of gives you some idea of the trends. So it is depressing. And what is this beyond showing us that there's a kind of steep decline in activism of protests of different kinds, from socioeconomic to political. It is actually concealing the difference, the kind of stuff that is going on beyond what we often see in the media. For instance, we know that civic activism in Russian regions and in Moscow in the various boroughs is very active. What are people doing? What are they protesting against? They're protesting against corrupt, unscrupulous mayors, developers that are corrupt. They're raising environmental concerns. So yes, protest has declined over the years, but people are still engaging in all kinds of activism, including, and I'll talk about this in a minute more, bread and butter type socioeconomic type protests. Strike activism is actually on the rise, and these kind of economic protests are on the rise. And why is it important that protests may be depoliticized, but people are engaging in all kinds of activities at a kind of neighborhood, local level, or indeed engaging in strikes and kind of labor, bread and butter type activism? Well, it is important because while people may not be directly challenging the political regime in the Kremlin, they're actually building very important skills, organizational skills. They're building networks, online and offline networks, with fellow civic activists across Russia. And these are the skills that will then morph, if political opportunities change at a national level, they will morph into something more, in kind of more politicized forms of activism. In other words, to put it in simple terms, people who are engaging in kind of civic or socioeconomic protests now, the same people might be joining the kind of 2011, 2012 type anti-regime protests. So the structures are there. So for instance, if you look at this chart, you see the dark bars are representing the socioeconomic protests, which are actually on the rise. Well, political is the lightly shaded bars there. You can see a little bit of a decline in the last few years, but these kinds of socioeconomic and other civic activism is actually very much alive in the regions. Unfortunately, regional activity, political activism, grassroots type protests, they're limited to just a handful of regions. Unfortunately, you don't see the names, but it's the usual suspects, you know, Samara, Nizhegorodskaya, Moscow, St. Petersburg. It's not just limited to these regions, but they often emerge as the most active of Russian regions. In other words, activism is still, you know, the democratic processes in Russia are still very much kind of uneven and are mostly concentrated in kind of some regions and not others. And I mentioned that the data I'm using, the Namart data, are by no means inclusive of all protest activism that occurs in Russia. Here's, for instance, an alternative source of data on protest, Center for Economic and Political Reform, and they've been gathering specifically a lot of data on socioeconomic discontent. And we see from the very recent data that actually strikes and labor-type activism, which is reflective of the kind of very dire socioeconomic situation in Russia for ordinary people, that's on the rise. So that kind of, one would think that these kind of dynamics of latent potential for political mobilization, that's a positive and a positive thing, and something we should kind of watch out for as we think of the approaching elections. However, as a scholar studying authoritarian regimes, I know that these regimes, and particularly Putin, President Putin, are very tactical and have learned to adapt to the dynamics of citizen challenges and mobilization and discontent, and they react tactically and often very promptly, and they do so using a combination of things. One is, the obvious one is repression. So if you look at this chart, you see the two lines converging, one of them towards the kind of later years. One is, one line represents protest activism, and that's going down, and the other one is the repression, that's going up. So there's kind of less protest activism and more repression. So repression is the standard toolkit of authoritarian regimes, and we know that's happening. The other interesting kind of trend that I find in my data is, we should ask ourselves, who do protesters blame? Why is that important? Because blame attribution is key to successful mobilization. If people don't blame the right kind of targets, they're not going to get what they want. And if we look at the political protests, which is the on the left, you see, those, of course, the activists blame, you know, the federal authorities, that is Putin, Medvedev, and the like. And these are the activists like Radiv Karamurza, you know, who others who are, you know, who know how to kind of frame political blame attribution in a kind of way that is appropriate. Now, a lot of the activism in Russia, in a lot of the activism, the blame targets are actually regional authorities, local authorities. In other words, the political regime is not often blamed on all the ills of Russia. And that's kind of, that's wrong, because people don't make the connection between, you know, the socioeconomic, political, and other woes like corruption and what is happening at the Kremlin, you know, like, or at the national level. And that could be partly because of the skillful media manipulation and the skillful ways that the Kremlin is able to deflect blame. And I can leave you with these couple of pictures on how Russian media framed protests. And there are different ways you can do it. You can either show happy, clappy, respectable-looking people wearing nice clothes and flags and looking very peaceful, or you can zoom in on images of violence, you know, police violence, like fire, etc., and say that, you know, these people like Navalny, they're going to bring another revolution and chaos and disorder and discontent. So the media have been very instrumental in kind of framing the protests in ways that could be quite negative, and they can even do so when young children as young as 14 or 13-year-old, as we know from the recent protests this year, you know, when you look at these images, you think of innocence, bravery, courage. Not so when it comes to the way the Kremlin spin doctors have framed this. They have spun these kind of protests in terms of shkolaka, which is like a derogatory word for, you know, school children who are used ostensibly as the cannon fodder for Navalny, who's manipulating. So there are these different dynamics of repression, media manipulation, reflecting blame, that are kind of something to watch as the elections approach and as we kind of see how the regime is adapting and to something interesting to watch is the interaction between these kind of very grassroots interesting political mobilization dynamics and the very tactical, skillful responses of the political regime. And I will leave us there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much, Vladimir. For you, I mean, everyone mentioned here, Alexei Navalny is either one of the two independent actors in Russian political space, together with Vladimir Putin, or somebody who is really inspiring a new wave of protest movements, which is, you know, qualitatively very different. How do you see, from your perspective, you know, how does the, you know, Alexei Navalny, you know, envisions, you know, his activism, and what prospect does he have for next elections?
Sure. Thank you, Oksana, for having me on this panel. And as somebody who has worked with Navalny quite closely since 2010, I would like to offer some thoughts on why Navalny has emerged as the most prominent Russian opposition figure. First of all, how do we conceptualize today's political situation in Russia? It's a fact that democratic forces in Russia are currently too weak to be able to take the current authorities heads on, because the political field in Russia has been bulldozed for 15 years, and the authorities have all the financial resources, all the administrative resources, and the democratic forces are weak. So at the same time, the political system that was put in place by Vladimir Putin over these 15 years is becoming unstable, and it's unlikely to survive in the foreseeable future. So what is the a realistic goal that opposition forces can have in front of them? And in our opinion, the goal is to make sure that we will have a place at a virtual roundtable where the future of how Russia will be governed at the next stage of its development will be decided. Once a political liberalization of some sorts starts. And a lot of political analysts talk about time frames and scenarios, but our strategy have to work regardless of them, because nobody has a crystal ball on how exactly this process will unfold. So what strategy can achieve this goal, the goal of increasing political capital of opposition, when the traditional feedback mechanism between the society and the authorities don't exist? There's no representative political system, there is no access to national mass media for opposition figures, and the strategy necessarily entails increasing public recognition, increasing your support base, building an organization, being flexible in your activities and the ways that you work, making sure that you have an attractive alternative to the vision of Russia that the current authorities represent, and maintaining moral authority in contrast with the corrupt regime. And Navalny and our team have been successful exactly because we have been following this strategy. When I met him in 2010, he was working from his small corporate lawyer's office with three associates. And now we have grown into an organization in Moscow which has about 30 full-time people and tens of people in different regions that are helping us on various aspects of our work. He has been attracting support base in different parts of society, including key people from the educated class. One of our close advisors for a few years already has been Sergei Gureev, who is one of the most renowned Russian economists. Overall, we think of what we do as playing on different chessboards. Navalny started as an anti-corruption campaigner, first focusing on graft and corruption in large Russian state-owned companies like VTB Bank, Gazprom, Rosneft, then moving on to investigating corruption of individuals, of Russian officials. These individual investigations remain a big part of what we do. In addition to anti-corruption investigations, since we don't have access to national media, and 70% of Russians get their information from national TV, we had to turn our operations into some sort of a media empire. It all started with Navalny's blog, which has a monthly audience of about 2 million unique users. And recently, we have been developing the new format for us for about 2 years, video. It's several formats. Every week, we put out a few videos of 5 to 6 minutes with Navalny talking about some important issue. Once a year, we issue a full feature investigation. In 2015, it was an investigation into Russian Attorney General Chaika. In March of this year, it was, as Richard said, an investigation into the property empire of Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, which has seen over 25 million views on YouTube. This year, we also launched a TV channel, Navalny Live, with weekly programs on topics ranging from economics to internet to law enforcement system. And the last but not least is political activity. It's not just getting on electoral ballots. I think it's all started in 2011 when Navalny launched his campaign against the party of crooks and thieves, and many political analysts credit this campaign it resulted in the fact that in parliamentary elections in December 2011, United Russia got less than 50% of the votes, and Navalny is widely credited for lopping off up to 10% of this result. The mayoral campaign in Moscow in 2013 was a big highlight of our political activities. Over a short period of 2 months, we were able to gather about 40,000 volunteers for our campaign, we were able to raise close to $4 million, and as a result, Navalny got 28% of votes of citizens of Moscow who came to the ballots, almost making it to the runoff round with the incumbent mayor, Sergei Sabin. A year ago, Navalny started another risky political project. He launched his presidential bid for the presidential elections in 2018, even though at that time and now Russian legislation prohibits him from running for the office and from being registered, and the authorities has numerous times reiterated that he won't be able to run. We are relying on the Russian Constitution, which stipulates that any Russian citizen who is not in detention is able to run for the office. And this campaign has been quite unprecedented in Russia. We opened over 80 campaign offices in many regions of Russia. We were able to do something which nobody has ever done before in Russia. Waves of mass protests in March of this year and in June, when the not only in Moscow or big cities people were taken to the streets, but in these two instances, over 100 towns were participating in this mass protests. These activities obviously didn't come without cost. Navalny, we calculated Navalny spent every 6 days since the campaign started in detention. And our offices are often subject to police raids. Our activists are often detained and are subject to convictions of from 5 to 20 days. The registration date for presidential candidates is coming quite soon. By the end of December, the Russian Electoral Committee will decide who will actually be allowed to be registered as a candidate in the presidential elections. And we believe that our goal is to create enough political pressure so that the authorities will see letting Navalny run in the elections as the lesser evil if he's not registered, we are prepared to make it quite painful for the authorities, and we'll have a plan for campaign for delegitimizing the coming elections. Also an important feature of what we do is maintaining moral authority. You know, Navalny, he has spent a year under house arrest. His brother, Oleg, is serving 3.5-year prison term on a politically falsified charges. Many our activists have been pressured. A few have been forced to leave the country. But despite all that, our office in Moscow and our campaign offices in 80 towns in Russia continue our work, and that gives us a lot of credibility in what we do. So that's a bit, a glimpse from me into what we do.
Thank you very much. That's very interesting. Get a sense of real political activism in Russia. Vladimir, coming to you really to give maybe the overview from everything what you said today, how do you see not only the evolution of opposition, but I think more broadly civil society? I mean, Open Russia supports the development of civil society. Do you think that the civil society in Russia now is ready to be able to take advantage of this opportunity for a more open politics that we might see in the coming years?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Oksana. I want to thank the LSE Institute for Global Affairs for organizing and putting together this discussion, and it's an honor to join distinguished colleagues on the panel here tonight to discuss what we still, I suppose by the force of habit, call an election in Russia in March of next year. It's been said that the surest sign of a genuinely democratic election is when you're certain about the procedure, but not certain about the result. Of course, for many years now, elections in Russia have followed the exact opposite model. Procedures have been changed and shifted in all possible ways to suit the needs of the incumbent authorities, while the end result is never in doubt. And of course, so it is today. The anointed candidate has not even officially announced his participation yet, but his victory, or should I say victory, quote-unquote, is an absolute certainty. I mean, to be sure, there were problems with elections in Russia in the 1990s too. But generally, elections in Russia in the 1990s were competitive, were pluralistic, and they certainly allowed voters to express their will. I'm old enough to remember when major presidential candidates in Russia, the incumbent president and the main opposition challenger, were separated by just 3% and had to go into a second ballot to decide the outcome. This was in 1996. I'm old enough to remember when parliamentary elections in Russia were actually won by the opposition. This happened in 1993 and 95. I'm old enough to remember the government and the president of Russia harshly criticized on national television. And I keep repeating this, that I'm old enough because let's not forget that there's now an entire generation of people in Russia who were raised, and in many cases born, under Vladimir Putin. He's been in power for more than 18 years, now officially longer than Leonid Brezhnev. So there's an entire generation that has no other political memory. And when I go around Russia, as part of my work with the Open Russia movement, we do a lot of work in the regions, and when I speak to these young opposition and civil society activists in the regions of Russia, I sometimes have to remind myself that I'm speaking to somebody who doesn't know anything except Vladimir Putin and his regime. We all know how the electoral process works in the Putin system. We know that it's controlled at every stage of the way, from ballot access and media access to administrative resources during the campaign to the corrections in a vote count. In fact, after the year 2000, not a single national election in Russia has been assessed by Council of Europe and OSCE observers as free, fair, and democratic. Not a single one. And I don't think we can expect any surprises with March 2018. We can talk a lot about all the problematic factors of the election of March 2018, but I think it suffices to mention just one thing. There were two prominent opposition leaders that were planning to challenge Vladimir Putin in 2018. One is Boris Nemtsov, and the other is Alexei Navalny. Boris Nemtsov is not going to run because, as we all know, in February of 2015, he was assassinated 200 yards from the Kremlin Wall. And Alexei Navalny, unless something astonishing happens, which I don't think will not be able to run because the Russian authorities have cooked up a politically motivated court conviction against him, as Vladimir has just described. The conviction, I must add, that was actually overturned by the European Court of Human Rights earlier this year. And what the Russian authorities did, they basically repeated it word for word, comma for comma, and just slapped it on him again. So, given the way that the electoral process is organized in our country, many of our colleagues in the opposition believe in the total boycott tactics, that we should be just ignoring and boycotting it. This sentiment is certainly understandable, but we at Open Russia disagree with it. We think that we should be using every single avenue and every single opportunity to challenge this regime and to present an alternative to this regime. And this includes the truncated, fake, unfree, unfair electoral process. And we think this upcoming so-called election of March 2018 should be used also to articulate an alternative vision for the future of Russia, a vision based on the rule of law, on genuine federalism, on honest elections, on a strong parliament. In fact, since 2015, Open Russia has been fielding and supporting candidates in local, regional, and national elections precisely with this goal in mind, with the goal of articulating an alternative. We also had another goal, which is education. In many ways, we use these so-called elections that happen in our country as a training ground for young opposition and civil society activists. We put them up through this process, through these campaigns, to help teach them the skills and the experience. Because even if you cannot win, you can still learn how to speak with people, how to go door to door, how to talk at rallies, how to publish leaflets and newspapers, how to organize local activities, how to organize in local issues. And I think they're the wiser for this experience. There was a famed Soviet pianist in mid-20th century. His name was Rudolf Kerr. He was an ethnic German, so when the war started in 1941, he was exiled along with his family to Kazakhstan. And he spent 13 years in exile, living somewhere in a wooden barracks in the steppes of Kazakhstan. And needless to say, he didn't have a piano with him. So what he did was he took out a plank of wood and a knife, and he carved out a fake keyboard and practiced on it every day, just so his fingers wouldn't forget. And then under Khrushchev, he was allowed to return from exile. He went on to become a soloist at the Moscow Philharmonic. He taught at the Moscow Conservatoire. He won the USSR Musical Soloist Competition in 1962. He was one of the most accomplished pianists of his time. And for 13 years, he had practiced on a plank of wood. This is what we're doing today. We want to use what opportunities, what possibilities we have to help prepare as much as we can. It's difficult to prepare for democracy under dictatorship, but as much as we can to help prepare this young generation for the future, for the time when they will be able to do the real thing. Because, of course, it is that new generation that will face the task of building a new Russia after Putin's regime. We have already seen this new generation. We have seen them all across the country in the last few months when tens of thousands of people went out to the streets all across Russia in almost 200 towns and cities, literally from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok, to voice their protest against the pervasive government corruption, but also against the political conditions that have allowed for this corruption. The lack of transparency, the lack of accountability, the lack of the rule of law. And at the end of the day, the sheer arrogance of the same small group of people that has now held power for almost two decades. And most of those protesters were representatives of that very generation that we already talked about today, the generation that was born and raised with Vladimir Putin. You know, these are people in their late teens and early 20s, university students, high school students. Again, those people who remember nothing except Putin and his regime, who have watched his face on their television screens for their entire lives. And it is that generation that is increasingly saying, enough. And I think over the long run, there is very little Mr. Putin can do about this. And I think this generation and the growing civic and political awareness of this generation is the best hope for a democratic future for Russia. And I just want to go back to with what we began, the election, so-called election. And since we're meeting in London, in the capital of our fellow Council of Europe and OSCE member state, I want to touch on the international aspect of this election. Now, as I mentioned already, after the year 2000, every single national election in Russia was assessed as not free, not fair, and not democratic. Observers from the countries of the Council of Europe and the Organization for Security and Cooperation Europe, in other words, from Western democracies, assessed the elections as not free, not fair, and not democratic. Yet every single time, the leaders of those same countries, of OSCE and Council of Europe, recognized the legitimacy of these elections and congratulated Putin on the outcome. Now, I have to tell you, I'm puzzled as to how those two things make sense simultaneously. I will never forget March the 5th of 2012. This was the day after Putin's so-called election victory in 2012. We had a big opposition rally to protest yet another rigged election. This was an evening on the 5th of March. The rally took place on Pushkinskaya Square, right in the center of Moscow, 2 miles down from the Kremlin. There were tens of thousands of people, and I remember on the stage what all the opposition leaders in Russia, Boris Nemtsov was there, Alexei Navalny was there, Grigory Yavlinsky was there, Garry Kasparov was there, many other people. And I remember standing on that stage and watching this, you know, the sea of faces and flags, all those tens of thousands of Russians who came to express their anger at the votes being stolen. And at exactly the same time we were standing there, there's an 8-hour time difference between Moscow and Washington. So this was about 7 p.m. in Moscow, so about 11 a.m. in Washington. And at the same time we were standing there, we got news that the U.S. administration had just issued a congratulatory statement, not only to Putin, which would have been half the problem, but actually to the people of Russia on having held the election. And I must tell you, this felt like an insult. And this is not limited to the U.S. That same day, on March the 5th, David Cameron, the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, became the first Western leader to call Putin and congratulate him. He was one of the first world leaders as well to do this. He called alongside Hugo Chavez and Bashar al-Assad. And I'll just leave it at that. We hope that there will be vigorous international monitoring of the upcoming so-called election in March 2018. We hope that our partners, our fellow member states of the OSCE and the Council of Europe, will send observation missions, will make their conclusions, and will hold the Kremlin authorities to account with regard to the international obligations on election standards that the Russian Federation has undertaken under such documents as the Charter of Paris, the OSCE Copenhagen document, or Protocol No. 1 to the European Convention of Human Rights. And if those conclusions of those monitoring missions are similar to what they have been every time for the last 17 years. We certainly hope that the leaders of Western democracies do not legitimize these so-called results and do not call to congratulate Putin on yet another successful theft, because that's in effect what they're congratulating him on. And I think this is the very least we can expect from the leaders of the countries that pride themselves on democratic governance and the rule of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vladimir. So I think we have now about 15 minutes, I think, for Q&A. If members of the audience, please raise your hand if you want to ask questions or make a brief comment. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, Jonathan Bradbury.
Hello, yes, John from Bradbury's. Thank you, first of all, for your very informative talks, Basit Bulshuri. Just to address a couple of points that you made, particularly the last one via Vladimir Karamirza. Obviously, we can look at the integrity of institutions, such as the OSCE, but we can't vouch for the backbone of the leaders of democracies. And that's always going to be a problem. And I would like to ask you all as a panel to address the fundamental problem, which is why we keep going back to Mr. Putin, which is how one may see a paradigm shift in the fundamental aspects of Russian mentality regards Putin. For example, in the UK, advertising a strong and stable leadership may be met with derision by the electorate, but in Russia that is a basic requirement. And Vladimir Ashurkov, you mentioned several times having the moral leadership, moral authority, but surely that in Russia is still held by the Orthodox Church, and who has the ear of the Orthodox Church? So what are your thoughts on addressing democratic institutions in Russia rather than individuals and promoting those, and also achieving reach into institutions that already exist in Russia, such as the church? Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Maybe we collect group? Yes, please. Yes, the last row.
Me?
No. Very nice.
Max Kendix, a student at a sixth form. The famous aphorism claims that the politician's career always ends in failure. I just wanted to ask the panel what they think Navalny's career is going to end in.
Okay. And then Mary. Can you get the microphone?
Sorry. Just a minute. My question is probably to Vladimir. If we look back to the early 90s when there was so much activity, one of the things which was surprising then was that actually students didn't play a very important part. And many of them said they were just too busy doing other things, earning money. Do you think that today's students, and by now I'm talking about, are we going to see MGU, are we going to see Leningrad University, St. Petersburg University, are we going to see the major student bodies actually showing any great activity in politics?
Okay. Maybe let's go back to the panel. So we should, but also maybe if you want to react to anything that other speakers have said, I think it's very marks and
yes. Okay, thank you very much. Just to say one in addition, before going to questions, just to say one thing, point which didn't really come up is the fact that you talk about the elections being flawed and staged, and obviously there's a lot in that. But I still think on the other side, since 2011, 2012, the regime, as you say, and Camilla said, learns, in other words, to do it perhaps more cleverly, to do it more intelligently, and to do it perhaps a little bit more honestly, because that may be the biggest trick of all, as it were. By that I mean the appointment of Ella Pamphilova at the head of the Central Electoral Commission. And she is, I think, a respected former ombudsman, human rights individual. And she certainly has a big improvement on Churyov, I think, before. So it's worth saying there's scope within the system, and we know that Volodin also was keen. Obviously, I've never said that they're for liberalisation, but it's for some sort of, to allow a tiny bit of change from below. Obviously, it was thrown out of kilter given the external relations, breakdown of relations over Ukraine and so on. So that's just one point. Second point, I mean, I think that when you say the Putin system becoming unstable, I'm not Vladimir saying that. Perhaps, we don't know, but I'd say that I don't see much evidence of the system itself becoming unstable. It's certainly changing and evolving in ways which is adapting to, you know, powerful challenges. And I think that this we'll see at a moment as a holding pattern, but after, clearly, after the fact that even, for example, Alexei Kudrin has become closer to, you know, advising on economic reform. He's always close to Putin, but actually now officially an economic advisor, in the sense that it may begin to respond to changes. So there's a couple of things. So, you know, that factory, the integrity of elections, in a sense, to say that, you know, it's the electoral politics is evolving, and it does give optimism. My third point would say, in that framework, I think it's absolutely right that the Open Russia movement and Mikhail Borisovich Khodorkovsky himself insists on participation on elections. I think that's hugely important, both for the reasons that Vladimir gives, which is to say, training ground, you know, that for civic activism. I saw a lot of Navalny's people, even just recently in the September elections in Moscow, you know, really great, giving out newspapers. I put one in my folder now, and so on. You know, it's amazing to see this sort of rebirth of politics, and it reminds me, perhaps a tiny bit older than you, and I remember back in the good old late Soviet days, when there's this sort of leaflets, pamphlets, young activists were out there, and it's great to see them back, I must say, it's good to see them back, but within the framework of constitutional politics. So the big question, ultimately, is that can this system evolve? And one reason I would say it can evolve is people like you and people like Vladimir working within the opportunities within the system, within the legal framework, because this is not a, you know, an oriental dictatorship or whatever bad words you want to use. It's a complex political organism in which there are opportunities for democratic change within the system. Of course, it's stifled at the moment, of course, but it's out there. So, and as for all careers, I thought everybody thought you were going to say Putin, but you said all, as Macmillan says, you know, all political careers. And Enoch Powell said it, we'll all fail. Navalny, of course, and that interests what others would say, there is some, you know, he's very much under attack from a lot of the liberals themselves because of his, maybe, his former nationalist tinge to it. I don't know, I mean, it'd be good to see it. I mean, do you feel that Navalny is perhaps, you know, very active, but losing a little bit, perhaps, of, I mean, I just got a report last week to say that people are getting a bit tired. I don't know whether that's true or not, but certainly it was maybe it's counter-propaganda out there. So, and that's what, it's not student activism. It's of course, all the figures show, it's school children in particular very active at the moment. Students are not engaged much in politics. I think there's, maybe Tamila has evidence to very good to hear, whether to see. But in my impression, I mean, I work quite closely at Moscow State University, you mentioned, High School of Economics in Moscow, almost nothing. I mean, a lot of political discussion, but not political engagement. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to address the question on paradigm shift. We know from comparative studies of authoritarian regimes that they do not voluntarily leave power. They die. Dictators die. And that's, you know, the Soviet experience certainly kind of is a testimony to that. Although recent developments in Zimbabwe do give us some grounds for hope with the departure of Robert Mugabe. But seriously, I think if we are going to see paradigm change, it will be at the juncture between the kind of what happens at the elite level and the societal level. And usually I think when we have major paradigmatic shifts in these kinds of regimes, it is when we see some kind of split at the level of elites. And I think that's, there is perhaps, I'm certainly not an expert on this, and maybe the Russian activists here would kind of illuminate that aspect a little bit more. But certainly I think there is some evidence that there is kind of a little bit or some evidence of these divisions at the level of the kind of the superstructure, the institutions and the elites in Russia. So when that happens, that's when those kinds of mobilizable constituencies that are protesting, that are taking part in political protests, civic protests, socioeconomic protests, that's when they will kind of join these kind of some kind of impulse that might come from the elite level. So I think we will, if we see that kind of juncture between elite splits and or a combination of elite splits and popular mobilization, I think that is when we are likely to see a kind of systemic shift in Russia. And on, just quickly on student, I think it's really more the case that the educational institutions, the regime is certainly attempting to use them, and certainly successfully is using the primary schools and that often serve as electoral polling stations as part of its kind of political machine, trying to pressure teachers into kind of falsifying votes, and people who are actually aggregating and counting votes at these precinct levels are often they're very vulnerable. They're state employees, and at the university level, there's a lot of intimidation going on of students and harassment and even repression. So I think I would look at it from that point of view.
I have been a few questions, so I'll try to briefly give my perspective of those. Mentality change and whether that's possible in Russia. I think history teaches us that there is just one constant, and that is change, and Russia is going to evolve. And the way we believe that the way for it to evolve is to follow the Western world, the Western civilization of which it is a part of, and embrace the values of representative government, free mass media, and independent judiciary. No opposition leader or movement can really influence such big processes as mentality change of the people. But I don't think it takes mentality change to effect change in Russia. Putin has pissed a lot of people off, and the system that he built faces a number of challenges which are unclear if the system can resolve. He has pissed the business elite because they have seen their fortunes decimated. They don't have access to international capital markets. And for such a sort of expert and investment-dependent economy as Russia, it is an important factor. He has pissed off the bureaucracy, which is seeing the economic pie and the budget shrinking so they can steal less. And naturally, Putin's expansionist policy over the last 4 years has been the primary reason for that. The real incomes of white populations have been falling for the last 3 years at least, and that's also doesn't make people happier. So I think we've seen it in other countries. This can translate into a political change. We don't know when, we don't know how, but I think it's kind of inevitable. The moral authority of somebody like Navalny and the Russian Orthodox Church, and I will combine it with a question from the gentleman on what Navalny's career is likely to end with. I'll give it my personal perspective. In 2010, I was a successful corporate executive at Alpha Group, one of the largest Russian investment holdings. And for some reason, I started helping Navalny, although I realized that I risked my career and maybe my liberty. But the way he resonated with me made it kind of natural for me to help a guy who is fighting this regime of political and economic corruption, which was preventing the prospects for development of Russia, along the sort of European path. And I started helping him, and I felt better. So even now, living in exile in London, I think I'm more happy than I would have been still toiling away at my office in Alpha Group. And I think my story is not unique. The way that Navalny was able to engage with people across the country, attracting volunteers to work in our campaign offices, the people who work there. You know, it's not just Moscow where you have a lot of attention of the press when police comes and arrests you for 10 days or takes all your electronic equipment. In regions, it's much more harsh. He was able to bring people to the streets, also something that people before him haven't been able to do. And I think a big reason of why he's able to do it is the moral authority that comes from the fact that despite all the pressure, despite his brother in jail, he's able to maintain his sort of witty sense of humor and his attitude. And it's not just his brother. As you know, he was attacked in March of this year, and he almost lost eyesight in one eye. The support of Navalny is not really incompatible with, orthodox religious values. They're just about different things. And nobody knows, nobody has the crystal ball to tell how Navalny's career will end up. But I think he has already made a difference. Just like Boris Nemtsov, whose career and life has ended, I don't think it has ended in failure, because he is a source of inspiration for thousands and Russian progressive thinking people. In terms of students, whether students of Moscow State University and other colleges are taking to the streets, yes, we see that more and more. And one feature of our communications, which we believe was helped us achieve that, is this turning from the text format to video format. We see increasingly that the young people, they don't read, they prefer to just watch a short video on their phones. And a theme that has resonated through Navalny's campaign, through his trips to the regions, and he has made over, I think, 70 trips. Every weekend he goes to the regions and visits three cities usually. The thing that people, and especially young people, are not happy about with Russia is not that they currently are living not very well, but it's that they currently don't have any prospects of living better. There are no social lifts, and the economy is not growing. The nice jobs at state corporations are occupied by the children of people who are already in power. And this disillusionment, this absence of prospects, is what drives people to the streets and what drives them to our campaign.
Thank you very much, Vladimir. So I think it's a very good point at which to pass the microphone to another Vladimir. And in addition to offering your views on the discussion here, maybe you can also start presenting
sure.
the film, because we're a little bit running late. So we just want to make sure that everyone have a chance to see the film. So.
Thank you. I'll be very brief, but I still want to address the points raised by members of the audience, because I think they're important ones. And I go in reverse order. So your question about the students, I think it is true that what happened in August 1991, for example, the democratic movement, late 80s, early 90s, the students were not a very prominent part of that. You're absolutely correct. But I think the experience of the last few months shows us that something is beginning to become different. And as we know, the students, both high school students and university students, were a key part, a major part of these nationwide protests that have been going on across Russia in the spring and again in the summer. And it's also important to note that it wasn't, as though their educational institutions looked favorably on this. And we all know the story of the school board from Bryansk. We know that in Tomsk University they had special sessions where they were being told that they're traitors and they're working for America or whatever else, the State Department, that's the usual name. We know that many of these students who came out to protest were put under pressure for doing this. But they came back again. They came back despite not only the pressure from their teachers and professors, but also despite the beatings by police and the arrests and the detentions and the 10, 15-day jail terms that many of them received. And in fact, there were many anecdotal stories of how, you know, very young people who came out to protest for the first time in their lives in March and got 15 days in prison for it and never got out of prison. You know, journalists would approach them and ask, so, well, presumably you're not going to go next time again. They said, no, next time I'm definitely going. So I think we're seeing a very positive trend in this regard, with students being much more involved, not even in politics, I would say, but in a civic movement for dignity. And they feel themselves more and more as citizens. I think, and this is from my own experience as well, over the past 3 years, I've been all across Russia, almost from Kaliningrad to Irkutsk, where Open Russia is working and present. I haven't made it to the Far East yet, but I will have to do that at some point. But even from the experience of talking to many of these young people, many of them students in the regions, I feel that with many of these young people, the self-awareness as citizens is gradually becoming stronger than the sense of fear of potential repression. I think that's a very important turning point. And it's a very bad turning point for the Putin regime. I think it's a very good one for Russia. The question, as Richard said, I think everybody in the room expected you to say Putin, not Navalny at the end. But the question was, do we think that Navalny's political career will end in failure? Well, I would say that you know, I don't think Alexei Navalny has even started his political career really yet, because, you know, how would you normally measure political careers? When somebody stands for elections, when he or she works in parliament, you know, presents their candidature for president or prime minister or whatever. Navalny is not permitted on a ballot. His party was refused registration. His brother was in prison. He himself, as Vladimir mentioned, spent probably almost more time now in police detention than in his office on Leninska Sloboda. I mean, I wouldn't call that a political career, really. So the only time when he was allowed in recent years to take part in an election, he got almost 30% of the vote, which is probably a major reason why they're not so keen on letting him run in 2018. So I would say let's see how he begins his political career and before we discuss how he's going to end it. And the last question, a very important one, a multifaceted question about whether it would take a paradigm shift to change the situation in Russia. I agree with what Vladimir has said. I don't think it will. And there are two levels I would touch on here. First of all, is that, you know, the Putin regime has been really successful in selling this idea that it is really popular. Even people who are against him often accept this. I don't think we should be accepting it as easily. How do we know he's popular? There are only two ways of judging whether a government is popular or not. It's election results and opinion polls. And we've already talked a lot about elections today. I don't think they have, well, almost anything to do with the actual opinions of the people. So, you know, that's not obviously a valid way of judging. And the second way is opinion polls. Well, yeah, we all know the 86% figure, or 90% sometimes, you know, 146, whatever they come up with. But frankly, I personally think that it's, you know, it's absolutely meaningless to talk about opinion polls in an authoritarian system. When, first of all, the regime, the government, controls the vast majority of the media and thus access to information. So that when, you know, a significant part of the population do not have access to objective information. But secondly, even more importantly, when people, you know, when they answer the questions from these pollsters, they inevitably weigh their answer against potential consequences. I mean, just imagine, you sit in your house, in your kitchen, in your apartment somewhere in Russia, you know, everything that's happening in the country. You know, people are beaten up for attending opposition rallies. You know, there are political prisoners. You know, opposition leaders are being exiled and killed and imprisoned. And, you know, you get a phone call, and some person you don't know asks you, or even worse, a knock on your door, and some person you don't know asks you, what do you think of Putin? What are you going to say? This is absolutely meaningless. You know, I would think that a much better way of judging the real position of this regime is how they themselves behave. You know, if you have 86% support, why do you need to rig elections all the time? Wouldn't you just win them? Why do you need to censor the media and keep your opponents from the air? Wouldn't you win the argument? Why do you need to beat up peaceful opposition protesters if you're so strong and popular? That's not the behavior of a popular government. That's the behavior of a weak and unsecure regime. So let's not accept on its face value this claim that the regime is popular. I don't think it is, and I think they know it. And a kind of a wider angle on this, a paradigm shift. You know, there has been this long entrenched stereotype for decades that somehow the Russian people are just not suited to democracy and freedom, and all they need, you know, is a strong hand and a stern whip. Well, you know, first of all, as a Russian, I find such a stereotype insulting. But also, and that's more important, I think, it's simply not true. I'm a historian by education, and, you know, we historians prefer to deal with facts as opposed to stereotypes. And if you actually look at the facts, then, you know, we will see that every single time the Russian people could actually choose in a more or less free election whether they want to live in a dictatorship or in democracy, they always chose democracy. 1906, the first election to the State Duma, when supporters of autocracy, of Tsarist autocracy, did not win a single seat, zero. and the election was won by the Constitutional Democrats, a leading pro-reform, pro-Western liberal party at the time. 1917, we marked the 100th anniversary this week of the election to the Constituent Assembly, the first ever election in Russia held on the universal suffrage with a secret ballot. The Bolshevik usurpers lost that election with their proposal of a dictatorship over the proletariat. It was won by the SR Party, which proposed a parliamentary democratic republic. And 1991, which is something in my memory, when the democratic opposition candidate, Boris Yeltsin, defeated the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the ruling party at the time, in the Russian presidential election by 57% to 17. So once again, let's reject this false and fake stereotype that Russians are somehow destined to live under dictatorship. This is simply not true. So I agree completely. It's not going to take a paradigm shift. It will take a lot of work and a lot of effort to change the situation in Russia. But we're doing the best we can in this. And Oksana, do you want me just to introduce yourself now?
Thank you very much. Yes, yes, please.
Okay, well, thank you so much for this opportunity. And I'll be very brief on this because I just want to say a few brief words of introduction because everything I wanted to say will be in the film. I just wanted to thank all those who made this film possible and who made it possible to have a screening here tonight. But before I do that, I just want to say that this is a film that should not have been made, at least not in a long, long time. And I have no words to describe what I would give not to have had to make it. It took me about a year and a half to make this documentary. The actual work took a year, but I had to take a long break in the middle, the reasons some of you may know. And this was a very educational process for me, apart from everything else. I learned many new things for me, and new things in the process. For example, I now know that it is very difficult, almost impossible, to make a film about a close friend who'd been murdered. This is without doubt the most difficult thing I ever did in my life, and at times I had to just drag myself by the hair, force myself to continue, not to stop, not to give up. I discovered a new level, or I should probably say a new depth, of human cowardice while I was working on this film. It's when people, for fear or for political expediency, refuse to appear in a film, refuse to say something good about someone who is dead just because he was an opponent of the current government. I'm not going to name any names, and I did not in Russia either when we were showing this film back home. It's not for me to judge. But I also had an opportunity to appreciate something much more important, and that is that political views and human decency have nothing to do with each other. And you will see very different people in this film, not just those who are in opposition, like Boris Nemtsov was, like I am, but also some who are very much a part of the present system in Russia. And it was very important for me that those who could have been afraid chose not to be. I wanted this film to be a portrait of the man as he was, as he really was, as I knew him, without the slander, without the propaganda, without all the lies and the cliches that there were so many around him and about him, especially in recent years. And you'll see very many different things in this film. There's just one thing you will not see in there, and that's death. There's no death in this film. There's no bridge. I could not have done this any other way. And in fact, many of the people that I interviewed for this documentary, when they spoke about Boris Nemtsov, inadvertently switched into present tense. Mm-hmm. I want to take this opportunity to thank those who helped me make this film possible. First of all, I want to thank the family of Boris Nemtsov for their help and support and advice, and for the invaluable archive that they gave me access to while I was working on this. I want to help my team. I want to thank my team of producers, Renat Davlet-Gildiev and Maria Leko. I could not have done this without them. I want to thank Open Russia and Mikhail Khodorkovsky for their support of this project, and the Institute of Modern Russia and Pavel Khodorkovsky for making it accessible to non-Russian speaking audiences. And I should add that a few months ago, the Russian government has designated both of those NGOs as, quote, foreign undesirable organizations that are prohibited from operating on Russian territory. But I must also say that apart from quite a few practical problems that this has presented us with, we certainly take it as a badge of honor coming from the current Kremlin regime. And above all, I want to thank my wife, Evgenia, whose patience, and that's another thing I discovered while working on this documentary, apparently has no limits. I want to say a huge thank you to our gracious hosts here tonight, the LSE Institute for Global Affairs, Eric Berglov, Piroshka Natamarashi, Oksana Antonenko for organizing and putting together this evening. And I want to thank every one of you who's here tonight. We have now shown this film in more than 30 cities in Russia, in many places outside of Russia. And everywhere we show it, we have a full house and people come and engage in discussion and ask questions and show interest. And I know it is because of him. And Boris Nemtsov always had this quality. Whether he was in government or in opposition, he would always bring people together. He always knew how to bring people together. And I can see that he continues to do this. And I think we'll continue to do this for a long time yet. Thank you very much.
Станция теплоснабжения рядом с деревней Федяково в Стовском районе Нижегородской области, в своем роде памятник эпохи. В ней и размах социалистического планирования на закате СССР, и резкая перемена в отношении ядерной энергетики после Чернобыля, и свидетельство о растущей силе общественного мнения, которое власть, даже советская, уже не может игнорировать. И именно Горьковская АСТ, а точнее движение против ее строительства, дало старт, пожалуй, самой яркой политической карьере в новой постсоветской России. Этот путь приведет Бориса Немцова отсюда, из закрытого города Горького, на вершины российской власти. Один из самых известных нижегородцев, Борис Немцов, родился в Сочи. В Горьке его мама Дина Яковлевна, детский врач, переехала, когда Борису было 7 лет. Жили вот в этой хрущевке на улице Крылова, в двухкомнатной квартире. Сначала втроем, потом, когда сестра вышла замуж и родила сына, уже впятером. К слову, здесь и сейчас живут родственники Немцова. Заниматься приходилось по ночам на кухне. Иногда, чтобы не мешать светом, закрывшись в ванной. Школу Борис закончил с золотой медалью. Правда, с поступлением в университет возникли трудности. В школьной характеристике написали «политически неустойчив». И это в середине 70-х, на пике брежневского застоя. Директор школы согласилась смягчить формулировку. Позволяет себе политически непродуманные высказывания. И Немцов поступает на радиофизический факультет Горьковского университета, который тоже заканчивает с отличием. Работать молодой ученый остается в Горьком, в НИРФИ, научно-исследовательском радиофизическом институте.
Физика – это его жизнь. Он ни о чем другом не мог вообще разговаривать. Мы с ним гуляли, и он мне рассказывал о том, чем он занимается. Я, естественно, физики ни в математике ничего не понимаю, но у Бори была такая особенность. Он мог очень сложные вещи объяснить на простых примерах. У него в НИРФИ, в их тюр-отделе, такая коробка была, и он на листах бумаги записывал свои идеи. Он запишет идею и бросит ее в коробку. В В это время он решает некую задачу, а идеи, тем не менее, приходят. И вот он запишет идею, бросит коробку, потом, когда решит ту задачу, он может подумать над другой идеей. Я говорю, ну и сколько у тебя этих идей там? Он говорит, штук 100.
Боря, как физик, это профессионал близкий к гениальности. Это не способный, не талантливый, совершенно другая категория. Это физик, близкий к гениальности. Более 60 опубликованных работ. Это где-то, понимаете, 5-6 работ в год серьезных сделать. Это нужно иметь сверхспособность. Гинзбург его обожал просто. Он его обожал. Он внучку свою хотел за него замуж выдать. Реально. Ну, теоретически хотел, Боря был женат. Теоретически. Поскольку он видел в нем такой потенциал, Виталий Лазович, лауреат Нобелевской премии. Вот уровень общения его. И это с молодым человеком, которого, в общем, как бы никто не знал.
За 25 лет он уже защитил кандидатскую диссертацию. В 33 годам у него была уже готова докторская. Ему нужно было только написать. Но случилось то, что случилось.
80-е – время больших перемен. Сперва осторожная смена курса, гласность и перестройка сопровождается ростом общественной активности. В Горьком главная тема перестроечных дискуссий – та самая атомная станция теплоснабжения. Экспериментальная, первая в мире, которая строится всего в нескольких километрах от миллионного города. Вскоре после катастрофы на Чернобыльской АЭС в Горьком возникает движение за ядерную безопасность. Его цель – не допустить запуска станции. В эту организацию входит и научный сотрудник радиофизического института Борис Немцов.
Политику моего отца провела моя бабушка, его мама, Дина Яковлевна. Моя бабушка решила собрать подписи в Нижнем Новгороде, тогда в Горьком, против строительства АСТ. А моего отца она привлекла для того, чтобы за ее словами стояли серьезные математические выкладки или выкладки физико-теоретика. Она первой села и стала собирать подписи против строительства атомной теплостанции. Вот с этого, в принципе, все началось.
«Меня стали включать в экологические проекты, приглашать на собрания», вспоминал Борис Немцов о своих первых шагах в общественной жизни. «В конце концов, я просто не мог оставить маму на площади в одиночестве». В июле 88 года в газете «Горьковский рабочий» выходит статья Немцова «Почему я против АСТ?». А в октябре он едет в Москву и встречается с академиком Сахаровым. Интервью, в котором физик-ядерщик с мировым именем, нобелевский лауреат и недавний горьковский ссыльный критикует идею строительства станции, выходит в газете «Ленинская смена».
Тогда еще действовала цензура. Дело в том, что помимо АСТ они еще говорили о